It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
I'm Brian Kilmeade.
I'm Martha McCallum.
I'm David Asman, and this is the Fox News Rundown.
Thursday, November 17th, 2022. I'm Jessica Rosenthal. Florida got all of the red wave attention these midterms at first, but there was another place that dove deeper into the political red after two election cycles in which Democrats' hopes were growing.
People are flocking to Texas, I think, in greater numbers than any other state, and they're leaving a lot of these other states that have gone in the opposite direction, and I think people end up voting more with their pocketbooks than they do on some of these issues that the Democrats ran on.
I'm Dave Anthony. What happened in Poland gave us a big scare that Russia's war on Ukraine could escalate big time.
We were, to some estimations, right up against looking at a World War III scenario.
And I'm Stephen Moore. I've got the final word on the Fox News Rundown.
Election night began with decisive GOP victories in the state of Florida. Miami-Dade County even went red for the first time in years. And while the red wave may not have materialized across the country as was expected, there were other pockets throughout the country where voters gave a resounding yes to Republican leadership, including in a state where shifting demographics have given Democrats higher hopes in recent years. Texas.
Together we will keep Texas the greatest state and the greatest country in the history of the world. God bless you all, and God bless our great state of Texas.
Governor Greg Abbott won a third term by double digits in a state former President Trump beat President Biden in by just over 5 points. After coming close to beating Senator Ted Cruz in 2018, Beto O'Rourke went after the governor's seat for the Democrats, blaming Abbott for the state's power grid failures, criticizing Republican leaders for stricter abortion laws, and loosening firearm carry rules.
We're going to win because we're fighting for every woman to make her own decisions about her own body, her own future, her own health care. We're going to win because we prioritize the lives of our kids over the interests of the NRA.
But Texas voters largely rejected his pitch, and Republicans won up and down the statewide ballot, including for lieutenant governor and attorney general. Republicans continue to hold the state houses as well. Texas, like Georgia and Florida, where voters also kept their Republican state leaders, gained congressional districts as people and businesses move there. Forbes says just last year, more than 60 companies relocated to Texas, and the state now has more Fortune 500 companies headquartered there than any other state.
We had Republicans that almost all won by, 10 points or more.
Ken Paxton is the state's attorney general and himself won a third term last week.
So it was pretty significant, which was better than 4 years ago. So I think part of it is we haven't backed down on the issues that matter to our voters. And two, we fought the election integrity battle, which we're not. Obviously, it never ends, and we've got to continue that fight. But we've at least stemmed the tide that some of these other states have not as it relates to what's going on in their elections and that taking, longer than it takes a third world country to count ballots. You've got a problem with accuracy.
I understand Democratic turnout wasn't as high as it could have been, given the demographic changes in Texas. We heard a lot about candidate quality on the Republican side heading into midterms. Do you think Democrats had a version of that in Texas, or was something else at play?
Look, I just don't think they had a good message. I mean, the message is what? That we have high inflation, we have a border that's out of control, energy prices, we're not energy independent anymore. We've got, wars in Ukraine, we lost Afghanistan. I mean, there's not much of a message for them to talk about, and I didn't hear much of a message. All they were able to come up with was a negative message on trying to blame, the governor for a shooting that has nothing to do with the governor, and the abortion laws are now controlled by the states.
Yeah, well, to that point, Beto O'Rourke and I think some other Democrats too. They said what you just said. They focused on abortion, restrictive laws in Texas in their minds, firearm carry rules, and the power crisis last winter. Certainly, energy, as you just referenced, and abortion were big issues this political cycle nationally. So why did Texas Republicans outperform other Republicans in other states?
Look, I think part of it is, our elections were a little more reliable. I'm not sure that we wouldn't have done better had Arizona been able to count votes on a timely basis. I'm not sure that Nevada has done a very good job. I'm not sure Pennsylvania has. I think it really does matter the votes are counted quickly, that they're counted accurately, and I think that that may have had an impact on some of these other states. We have done a better job with our election integrity because our message was similar to other Republicans, I think, and it may be also that we've had more success with our economy, with jobs, low taxes, and people, you know, are flocking to Texas, I think, in greater numbers than any other state, and they're leaving a lot of these other states that have gone in the opposite direction. And I think people end up voting more with their pocketbooks than they do on some of these issues that the Democrats ran on.
Yeah, I'm from California. I can tell you people have left my state to go to Texas and Florida. Texas has led the way on changing abortion laws, making them more restrictive, even before Roe was overturned. With the lack of a national red wave, do you think red state leaders will be discouraged to push more abortion-related policies? I mean, even I think Kentucky rejected a constitutional amendment on this.
Look, I don't know. I think the legislature made a decision to protect the unborn from having their lives terminated, and that seems to be a position that the legislature feels strongly about because they certainly put both the heartbeat bill in place, and then they also put the trigger bill, which, you know, eliminated abortion of unborn children up to the entire 9 months.
And there is an exception, right, to save the life of the mother?
Yeah, there is.
So can you, I was reading this interview with this woman, Amanda, I don't know how to pronounce her last name, Zarowski. She says that in her second trimester, she was not able to hold the baby anymore and she was going to miscarry, but doctors in Texas told her they couldn't perform an abortion under the state law and that they had to wait until she basically like either got sick or that her life really was in danger. And this was like a baby she wanted, by the way. And she did end up going into sepsis. As the attorney general, like, could doctors in this case have acted sooner? What is the guidance here so doctors could help in a case like that and not fear, you know, prosecution?
I'm not a doctor, but all I know is if the life of the mother's in jeopardy, they can respond. And so this idea that, you know, you can't do that legally, that's incorrect. So doctors may have told her that, but they have an obligation to take care of that woman if she is in danger and make sure that she's okay and protect her health and her life.
So it's up to them, right, to make that call to say, like, let's not let you get to a certain point.
Yes. They're just saying you can't kill an unborn baby unless there's some danger to the mother.
One of the big topics Republicans focused on heading into election night was an issue Texas leadership has been highly critical of the Biden administration about, and they've been pushing their own actions to counter what they say are weak federal policies on the border. After a fiscal year in which a record 2.4 million migrants were apprehended, with hundreds of thousands of known gotaways on top of that, Texas Governor Greg Abbott began using local law enforcement to respond to border-related issues. He also sent busloads of migrants to Chicago, New York, Washington, D.C., and now Philadelphia. This week, a federal judge in the D.C. district said Title 42 was unconstitutional. The COVID-era policy resulted in migrants being turned away at the border. He found it arbitrary and capricious and ruled it violated the Administrative Procedures Act. Art Del Cueto is the former head of the National Border Patrol Council.
This is just horrific to even think. The floodgates had already been opened, but with this, you're pretty much handing the keys over to our borders, to the criminal cartels and the smuggling organizations.
Governor Abbott announced he was invoking the invasion clauses of the U.S. and Texas constitutions to, quote, fully authorize Texas to take unprecedented measures to defend the state against an invasion. He did that just hours before the Title 42 ruling.
I mean, they're still using Title 42 to send people back. So, yes, I mean, look, we know the Biden administration doesn't respect federal laws that they disagree with, and they just basically not just ignore them, they directly violate them. And Title 42, they clearly don't want to enforce that. This means we're going to have more illegal immigration. The numbers are astronomically high, highest they've ever been in U.S. history. And the Biden administration is continuing to try to basically dismantle any type of protection for the citizens of the United States.
And Governor Abbott sent another bus of migrants to, I guess now this is the fourth city, Philadelphia, right? And I'm just wondering, is there a long-term plan here? Like, what would have to happen at the federal level for Governor Abbott to say, okay, I'm we don't need to do this anymore. We don't want to do this anymore.
No. These sanctuary cities conveniently were sanctuary cities during the Trump administration and complaining about that he was protecting the border. Well, now they have a president who's not protecting the border and they get a few hundred people. Suddenly being a sanctuary city is not so good with them because they have to deal with the actual problem that we deal with every day. Obviously, they have to deal with it in a tiny amount compared to what we do. Yes, it's a problem for us because we are overwhelmed with problems related to what the president is doing to this country, whether it's drugs and deaths from, you know, fentanyl, or whether it's, you know, human trafficking, or whether it's costs associated with trying to educate people that are coming to the country, you know, take care of their health care, dealing with law enforcement. It is a significant impact on the citizens of our state, and the fact that Texas suffers, you know, most of the brunt of that, and sure, in some of the other border states, and so the country hasn't suffered to the same degree. Maybe a small degree, they get a few hundred or a few thousand. The reality is, if the punishment is going to come from the president, and he's going to punish America and make us endure the downsides of higher crime and higher costs, then we ought to be able to share the burden of his punishment.
Finally, I know that most of Texas went red, right? But there was that pocket in South Texas that Republicans had high hopes for, those House congressional seats. And they only got one, right? The Republicans only got one, and the other two kept their Democratic incumbents. It did seem like a good night for most incumbents, despite people, you know, wanting a different direction for the country, it seemed, on both sides. Was the border argument not resonating in that particular area, or was it just not enough of a message from Republicans in that particular area of Texas?
Look, we're making progress. Clearly, the fact that we won one that we've never won before is pretty significant. The fact that we might have been trying for more is not any kind of negative on our message on what we're trying to do. I just think it's a trend. I think the impact of Biden's policies, whether they're economic or whether they're border related or whether they're drug related, crime related, or, you know, law enforcement related, they're all negatively affecting all Americans. And so that has an impact on voting. And I think that's what's happening in Texas. And I think that's what's happening to the country. As we feel more of the impact as this year comes upon us, more and more Americans are going to lose their jobs. More and more people are going to be dealing with the problems of inflation. And they're going to be dealing with, you know, drug crisis increasing, dealing with the cost of illegal immigration. So the very negative things that the Biden administration is bringing to people eventually affects voting.
Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton, thanks so much for your time.
Yeah, thank you. Have a great day.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network.
I'm Ben Domenech, Fox News contributor and editor of the Transom.com daily newsletter. And I'm inviting you to join a conversation every week. It's the Ben Domenech Podcast.
Subscribe and listen now by going to FoxNewsPodcasts.com.
This is Stephen Moore with your Fox News commentary coming up.
It was an unfortunate accident.
There are absolutely no indications that it was a direct attack on Poland.
That's what President Andrzej Duda says about the missile that hit his country Tuesday, killing two people. U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin says
this explosion was most likely the result of a Ukrainian air defense missile that unfortunately landed in Poland.
Here's Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman General Mark Milley.
I suspect very shortly we will have very confirmed data as to what the point of origin is, point of impact, what the angle of the weapon system was, the flight trajectory.
Even though it did come from Ukraine, it was again in self-defense. So NATO leader Jens Stoltenberg says
this is not Ukraine's fault. Russia bears ultimate responsibility.
Now, the initial reports were it was a Russian attack, and it raised serious concern. President Biden and other world leaders at the G20 summit in Indonesia held an emergency meeting since Poland is a NATO ally.
We were, to some estimations, right up against looking at a World War III scenario for at least a few minutes.
Greg Palcott is Fox News' senior foreign affairs correspondent, and he's in Ukraine's capital, Kyiv.
NATO has the Article 5 charter that states emphatically that any attack on a NATO member is an attack on all NATO members, and that they would respond with some kind of action not necessarily military, but could be as high as that. Well, that was the first few minutes. And then what is apparently confirmed by Polish authorities, by U.S. officials, and by NATO is that a Russian missile, part of a huge barrage we saw here against various targets in Ukraine, a Russian missile went at least close to the Polish border. I'm thinking, looking at a map, it might have even been in Polish airspace. And then, apparently, according to the analysts, a Ukrainian air defense missile took it out or was aiming to take it out there. And, well, something happened. Either it did take it out and all the fragments went over into Poland, or the Ukrainian air defense missile missed the Russian missile and it itself went into Poland. But something happened. It fell, it landed in Poland about 4 miles deep into the country away from the Ukrainian border. Two people were killed. It was a huge incident. But now, now it looks like it's settling down. But at least for a couple of hours, and maybe for even longer than that, this Ukrainian war, which of course is a huge crisis, not just for Ukraine, but for the entire world, looked like it could be even bigger than that, Dave.
Yeah. Well, now in Ukraine, though, that's one of many Russian rockets that they've had to deal with. You talked about the barrage on Tuesday. It was something like 90 different Russian missiles that came in. Ukraine shot down something like 77 of them, but that still means that others did hit. And it's been a barrage for weeks now targeting Ukraine infrastructure. It's really getting difficult to live in that country, isn't it?
Getting very difficult, Dave. What Vladimir Putin, I think, is assessing now is that he's not doing all that well on the battlefield, but he knows he's got weapons of mass destruction, and they can hit targets, civilian targets, all across this country, and that can cause as much problems for this country as any battlefield game. So, yeah, we were here at our hotel. We heard the air raid sirens. We heard explosions not too far away. And in fact, there were targets hit in Kyiv, about 20-minute drive from where we are. We went over to one to see what was happening. An apartment building, a residential neighborhood hit, and one person killed, one person injured, fire, wreckage everywhere. This is what Vladimir Putin likes to do, starting about 5 or 6 weeks ago. That's the new strategy, hitting civilian power grid infrastructure targets and doing damage to the electricity, to the water, which depends on electric pumps, remember, to central heating. A lot of the places here involve central heating. And when you don't have electricity, that impacts mobile phone service, what have you. This is the new strategy, and this is what Ukraine is dealing right now. It's another front in the war here, Dave.
Yeah, and it's not winter yet, but it's probably feeling like it, right? What's the temperature in Kyiv at nighttime now?
It's been remarkably mild here for the we've been here now for about 2.5 weeks, and it's been remarkably mild. But now our nights are going below freezing. So, you know, we're down in the high 20s or so Fahrenheit.
Yeah.
Our days are still mild enough, but we've been looking at the AccuWeather long-range forecast, and there are some cold weeks ahead. But they're still dealing with regular scheduled power outages. They call them blackouts, but it's really, you know, turning off the power for about 4 hours in the morning and 4 hours in the evening to try to conserve energy. So this is a fact of life now. So the war is really hitting home here on all fronts for Ukrainians, Dave.
The U.S. will continue to help Ukraine defend itself, sending more aid and weapons and ammo.
I can do nothing but applaud the courage, determination, and capacity of the Ukrainian people and the Ukrainian military.
That was President Biden on Monday reacting to the liberation of Kherson, where Ukrainians poured into the streets, cheering a Russian retreat from the largest city captured during the invasion amid a Ukrainian counteroffensive.
If I can just talk for a moment, these scenes in Kherson of the Ukrainian soldiers riding in their trucks, getting out of their cars, being hugged, being kissed by the locals, flowers being brought to them, food being brought to them.
I thought of it immediately, and I thought I was a little bit off base, but then I saw several other analysts pick it up. It looked like Paris, 1944, when the GIs rolled in and liberated that city from the Nazis. It was similar, at least in emotion, maybe not in scale. And it was a big moment for Ukraine. President Zelensky went down there on Monday. A little bit daring because you only have there's Russian-occupied territory only about 8-9 miles away. So it was a bold move, but you're right. Now there are power shortages, there is water shortages, food, medicine, communications are just getting up again, TV, mobile networks. These guys, when the Russians were pushed out and they withdrew, but they were pushed too by the Ukrainian forces, they left a trail of destruction behind them, and now they're just picking up the pieces down there, Dave.
Is there a feeling that this counteroffensive is going to drive Russia out totally? Do Ukrainians start to believe that they can win this overall?
Well, you talk to any Ukrainian, and we talk to a lot of them. You know, we've talked to folks here in the last couple of days here in Kyiv, and we've had one kid say, Russia is a terrorist state. You know, and another one said, you know, absolutely, they are finished. We are never giving up. And that's what you hear just about from everybody. And I think that's what Washington and others are up against when they're saying, yes, we want to help Ukraine as much as possible. Yes, we're pleased with all the gains, but maybe we should think about starting to talk to Vladimir Putin and Russia and maybe negotiate some ends because there's been so much death and destruction. You talk to people here, they don't want to hear about it. They've had successes. They want to push on, whether that's likely or whether it'll slow down the gains in the coming months, and people talk about months and months still. That's up to the experts and the military officers. But you talk to people here, they want to fight to the finish.
You know, there's a story I read from the Kyiv area that sort of puts the toll on it, though. I know that they're wanting to battle Russia and they want to win, but the amount of sorrow there. A 69-year-old woman was visiting her husband's grave, and a fragment of a rocket came down and killed her. So it just shows there's just been so much death there. Everybody must know somebody who was killed at this point.
Absolutely. I mean, we spent some time in a cemetery just about 2 days ago, and big cemetery in the center of Kyiv, a lot of old graves, but they have literally built a new section of the cemetery to accommodate the graves of those who have been fallen just in the past year in this war. And we spent about 2 hours there, and we talked to several people. A mother absolutely broke down because her 21-year-old son was killed in the very tough fighting in the east. We talked to his girlfriend, too, and, you know, these are lives that are absolutely either snuffed out or altered for the rest of their lives. And we talked to other people whose friends, and there are older people fighting too in their 50s, and believe it or not, in their 60s. We saw some folks honoring the loss of their 63-year-old friend who was killed in fighting. So yes, the losses are out there. We were at a church too for a funeral, and it was just crushing. The daughter of a man who was killed in fighting. I remember her words distinctly, Dave. She said, you know, he told me stories when I was a kid. He was very good at inventing animals. He helped me go to sleep. And she just has memories right now. The total figures are amazing. And General Milley, he thinks there were 100,000 Russian soldiers either killed or injured just in the last 9 months of fighting, and that he thinks there's about 100,000 Ukrainian soldiers killed or injured in the last 9 months of fighting. So we're looking at 200,000 casualties there. And he says about 40,000 civilians have been killed.
And millions had already fled the country, too, right when the invasion started.
Oh, yeah, millions and millions. Millions have gone. Some have come back. And now the concern is that with these huge power outages, and again, we were talking about weather earlier, it's just beginning to get cold. When it gets frigid, and I have been here when it's totally frigid, people aren't going to want to shiver in their apartments or literally risk their lives. They're going to think about maybe going over either to the western side of the country or even back over, joining millions who remain outside of this country in places like Poland, Hungary, and Romania.
I mean, there is the real risk of a lot of people freezing to death this winter. Am I right?
They are preparing for the worst this winter. We've talked to the CEOs of the two top utilities here, and yeah, they probably want to get attention and hope for more Western aid, but they were grim. They were grim about what the prospects could be for this winter. They said, both of them said to me in separate interviews, that this could be a huge humanitarian catastrophe if the Russians continue their attacks and they just can't keep up with the repairs, Dave.
Greg Palcott, Fox News senior foreign affairs correspondent in Kyiv. Thanks so much for joining us.
Dave, thank you. And thank you to your listeners. Thanks.
Meet the American who
created crash test dummies.
Samuel Alderson was born in Cleveland in 1914 and raised in California. At the University of California, Berkeley, he studied under J. Robert Oppenheimer, renowned physicist and father of the atomic bomb. Alderson became a prolific inventor. During World War II, he worked on military technology for the U.S. government. After the war, he created dummies for military test aircrafts for atomic bomb testing as well. With highway deaths surging in the 1960s, Alderson was enlisted to create anatomically accurate crash test dummies. His first crash test dummies for the auto industry, introduced in 1968, and an updated model was patented in 1981. Alderson's product drastically improved the safety of car passengers. It saved as many as 330,000 American lives and prevented millions of injuries. Crash test dummies today are made of a variety of materials, stainless steel or aluminum bones, rubber cartilage for neck vertebrae, and vinyl composites for flesh. I'm Gianna Gelosi. Go to the lifestyle section of FoxNews.com for more of these incredible American stories.
Coming November 21st, Fox News Rewind Financial Crisis 08. A look back at the biggest financial crisis since the Great Depression.
The market is not functioning properly.
Subscribe now at foxnewspodcasts.com. Subscribe to this podcast at foxnewspodcasts.com. It's time for your Fox News commentary. Stephen Moore. What's on your mind?
Imagine someone close to you has a drinking problem. Night after night, he goes out to the bars on wild binges, chugging down 10 to 12 beers a night. But then, in a supreme effort to reform himself, the drunkard cuts his consumption down to only a six-pack every night. He starts boasting of his amazing self-control and good behavior. That's analogous to President Joe Biden's tall tale that he's one of the greatest paragons of fiscal responsibility in modern times. Biden's administration has led the federal government in spending and borrowing into more money in his first 20 months in the White House than any other president in history. Biden is not even halfway through his presidential term, and he's already signed into law federal spending over the next decade that will exceed $4 trillion. I recently went back and looked at what the Congressional Budget Office baseline for deficits was the month President Donald Trump left office in January 2021. Then I compared that to Biden's fiscal records so far in his first 2 years in office. Here's exactly what I found. Biden has already added just shy of an extra $900 billion to the federal credit card in 2020 and 2021. If Biden had simply done nothing and spent his afternoons playing Scrabble with First Lady Jill Biden in the Oval Office, our national debt would be much lower. Instead, Biden swooped into office, and even though Donald Trump, in his final weeks in office, enacted a $1 trillion COVID-19 relief bill that hadn't even been spent yet, Biden called for his $1.9 trillion American Rescue Plan. That was merely a massive bailout of blue states that had kept their businesses locked down for nearly a year. It was entirely unnecessary. Then came another $1 trillion for the scam, quote, infrastructure bill, unquote, which is really the Green New Deal in disguise. It then was followed by a $600 billion corporate welfare bill for microchip manufacturers. To add even more insult to this economic injury, because of runaway inflation under Biden, the Federal Reserve Board has been forced to raise interest rates on federal debt 4 times. This has already added yet another $1 trillion to the debt just to pay the interest on the debt that Biden has already racked up. The total amount of spending reduction to offset the Biden budget blitzkrieg adds up to a big fat zero. But sure, he's the number one deficit cutter of all time. And if you buy that, you also probably believe that O.J. Simpson was innocent. I'm Stephen Moore, a senior fellow at the Heritage Foundation and an economist with FreedomWorks. My latest book is Govzilla, How the Relentless Growth of Government is Devouring Our Economy.
You've been listening to the Fox News Rundown. And now, stay up to date by subscribing to this podcast at foxnewspodcasts.com. Listen ad-free on Fox News Podcasts Plus on Apple Podcasts. And Prime members can listen to the show ad-free on Amazon Music. And for up-to-the-minute news, go to foxnews.com. Listen to the all-new Brett Baer podcast featuring Common Ground, in-depth talks with lawmakers from opposite sides of the aisle, along with all your Brett Baer favorites like his all-star panel and much more. Available now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Guy Benson. Join me weekdays at 3 p.m. Eastern as we break down the biggest stories of the day with some of the biggest newsmakers and guests. Listen live on the Fox News app or get the free podcast at GuyBensonShow.com.